This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. Program was homecrafted and recorded on November 11th. In an article in The Guardian last week, Julia Carey Wong noted that the constant drumbeat of lies and disinformation from the president has been intimidating, to say the least. Despite all the attention that has been focused on foreign interference, she claims that, in reality, the biggest threat to American democracy right now is almost certainly the commander-in-chief, and that his primary mode of attack is a concerted disinformation campaign. Wong cites Claire Wardle, who heads First Draft, a group that researches and combats disinformation. Wardle paraphrases Trump's election messaging. Don't trust the election system. Don't trust the CDC. Don't trust your neighbor because they're probably Antifa. Don't trust the left. It's not about persuading people one way or the other. It's about making them scared and causing confusion and chaos. The media's been obsessed with Russians under the bed, but to have the President of the United States telling people in the U.S. that they can't trust the results of the election, Putin could only dream of that kind of thing. Part of the problem is the sheer volume of information that inundates us every day. Sean Illing wrote a piece for Vox earlier this year in which he describes a novel form of propaganda that has been enabled by the digital age. It works not by creating a consensus around any particular narrative, but by muddying the waters so that consensus isn't achievable. In 2018, Steve Bannon, one-time chief strategist for President Trump and head of Breitbart News, reportedly summed it up thus: "The Democrats don't matter. The real opposition is the media. And the way to deal with them is to flood the zone with, let's say, excrement." Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Sam Woolley, assistant professor in the UT School of Journalism and the UT School of Information. He's also director of UT's Center for Media Engagement and author of The Reality Game, How the Next Wave of Technology Will Break the Truth. We also have our regular guest, Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. And Michelle Manning Scott is with us too. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us again, Sam. How you been?
Thanks for having me. I've been well, you know, all things considered. We've been living in a wild and wacky world.
Indeed. To remind our listeners, Sam was on last February, and we focused largely on his book at that time, which had just come out, I think, a few weeks before that. Tonight, we're going to try to wind the clock forward a little. I think there's been quite a bit has happened during the last 9 months or so in terms of fake news and misinformation. Sam, you've been at this for, as far as I can tell, for about 8 years now, right? You did some earlier work in Palo Alto and at Oxford, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I started doing this research into what my colleagues and I back at the time called computational propaganda at the University of Washington in Seattle when I was doing my PhD. started doing it back then, just during the Arab Spring and all that kind of stuff. And then I eventually moved over to the University of Oxford, where I managed a research project that my colleague Phil Howard and I founded called the Computational Propaganda Project. And that was pretty internationally focused. We were oriented towards studying the ways in which social media tools like bots were getting used to manipulate public opinion all around the world. And then I went out to Palo Alto for a couple years and worked at this think tank there called the Institute for the Future, where I founded a research lab called the Digital Intelligence Lab. It was aimed mostly at sort of engaging with the social media companies and getting them to think about a lot of the propaganda research that I'd been doing. And then last August, I ended up here in Texas. I'm really happy to be here and to be at UT, and I oversee the propaganda research lab. And it's been a weird first year in Texas, but I guess that's true to the spirit of Austin.
I think it's been weird everywhere in the world. You know?
That's very fair.
Maybe we could just start off with some basic terminology. The term misinformation and disinformation gets used a lot. Could you clarify the difference between the two?
Sure, yeah. Misinformation and disinformation tend to get conflated. Misinformation specifically means the accidental spread of false information or content. So misinformation is something that, you know, your friend or your grandma or someone might do without really, they might share something on social media without knowing that it's actually fake. Disinformation is something altogether different. Disinformation is the intentional spread of false information. So disinformation is usually the kind of thing that political organizations do with the intention of disinforming you, getting you to spread false content as misinformation. So oftentimes, I guess the distinction there is that what begins as disinformation amongst, say, political organizations oftentimes turns into misinformation spread by well-meaning people.
Got it. So intentional fake news would be disinformation then.
That's right. So what people refer to as fake news is actually like falsely created news articles or organizations created to look like news entities that then spread disinformation actively. So that's right. They would be more in the disinformation category.
Right. Are there other terms that we should define up front here?
Yeah, sure. So there's two other things that maybe we should think about. One is propaganda. Propaganda is a term that kind of dates back to the Catholic Church when they were using the term to refer to an entity within the church that was spreading the sort of the word of Catholicism. So it didn't have as much of a negative connotation at the time. Around the turn of the 19th century, it kind of gathered this more negative connotation, including going into World War I. And you had people like Bernays, who was the nephew of Freud, doing work to try to talk about how propaganda was useful to democracy. He was a little bit of a shill for propaganda. And so propaganda is this phenomenon that is communicated, loaded political information, I guess is how we would define it. And then the other thing is information operations, which is this term that we're seeing more nowadays. And information operations is a term that grows out of military doctrine and the usage in the military. And it refers specifically to coordinated efforts to manipulate information, oftentimes for the sake of organized actors like a military or intelligence agencies and things like that.
Got it. When you were last with us, it was in the co-op studio of distant memory.
yeah, that's all right.
We have not been back there. We've been doing all this through Zoom in the intervening months. And at that time, you know, there was a kind of a hint that this epidemic might be headed our way. We'd already had the news of it devastating China. And of course, it was only a few weeks after that when everything shut down by the middle of March. You know, this had kind of turned into a ghost town, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd like to focus a little on just the flow of information or the kind of information that was being shared or misinformation or disinformation, for example. You know, I mean, there's some evidence that in China, the government there was exerting a fair amount of effort in trying to suppress information about the epidemic among its own people and internationally as well. Yeah, do you want to comment on that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, during any political crises or social crises or natural disaster over the last 10 or so years, we've seen sort of the disinformation actors and propagandists kind of come out of the woodwork in an attempt to control the dialogue. And COVID is certainly no exception. And in fact, COVID is quickly becoming one of the moments wherein we're seeing more digital disinformation spread than ever. That includes the Chinese government's efforts to hold back information on the environment or to spin claims about like how, you know, how, where, when the environment, the virus originated. That also includes by proxy, you know, groups in the United States, including Donald Trump and the Republican Party's efforts to sort of like, you know, spin the information about this being a Chinese virus that originated in a lab and this and that. Disinformation has been rampant. Regular people on both sides of the aisle have been spreading a lot of misinformed content. I think with COVID, what we've seen happen is, you know, a more popular embracing of things like anti-vaccine conspiracy, anti-mask wearing conspiracy. Of course, there's always been sort of a strong contingent of people who are against things like vaccines, but it's really interesting that wearing a mask has become a political issue. And, you know, one of the reasons primarily why this has become a political issue is because there's been a lot of dis and misinformation spread about mask wearing, not to mention the fact that not wearing a mask has been endorsed at the highest levels of government. Simultaneously, we've also seen the growth in conspiracy theories like QAnon, which kind of has dipped its toes, you know, actually probably, you know, better to say it's sort of submerged itself in conspiracies surrounding coronavirus. This QAnon conspiracy has been picked up more broadly and spread amongst lifestyle bloggers and a lot of other folks who are now beginning to, simultaneous to spreading QAnon conspiracies, also spread conspiracies related to coronavirus. For instance, one of the ones I saw recently was that 99.9% of children cannot get coronavirus, which is patently false. You know, you just see a lot of problematic content out there surrounding this virus. And it's partly because people are panicked, but it's also partly because there's people out there that want to control the way that people think about this.
Yeah. Going back to the masks, for example, you know, early on, there was some confusion, some honest confusion, where I think it was government agencies not really recommending mask usage because of a fear that they were going to run out. You know, I wonder if it was that the point where this thing started to go off the rails, or do you have any sense about how all this developed in March and April?
Sure. I think that there was sort of government recommendations surrounding mask wearing, actually suggesting that people didn't need to wear a mask. That was to do with, you know, misunderstandings about how the virus spread. But what we now know from reporting from Bob Woodward and other folks is that people at the highest levels of governance, including the president, did know that the coronavirus spread in such a way that we should probably be wearing masks. You know, there's been sort of this massive backlash against mask wearing because it's perceived, or it's been framed as a violation of people's rights, their constitutional rights. You know, when in fact, like, by and large, what you see coming from the scientific and medical community is the suggestion that this is, if anything, this is something that you're doing to help your fellow citizens, not something that you're doing to restrict yourself.
And we watch this, you know, play out every day. I'm just curious if you've got any insights about how this actually happened. It's so illogical. I mean, is it just this sense of personal freedom, or is this like an obstinate two-year-old saying no, you know, digging in their heels and saying this is coming from the government, therefore I'm opposed to it?
You know, I think that we underestimate the amount of power in top political officials and what we maybe would call influencers or pundits, positions on things. And we've seen people in the top levels of the Trump administration, but also across like multiple vectors of the media sort of speaking out against mask wearing. And I think that has effects attached to it. We've been able to see in the research that over the course of the last 4 years, Donald Trump has held tremendous sway over his group of closest supporters. And so what he say really goes with those people, including what's happening right now surrounding completely unfounded allegations of fraud during this election. And so I think that we can point blame at the Trump administration here. Like, and I think that they have to accept that blame for decisions about sort of decrying mask usage or, you know, sticking to the line that was towed by healthcare officials saying originally that we didn't need to wear masks, but then that we did, but refusing to kind of get away from that. To get back to your question, what's caused this? Why is there so much conspiracy around mask wearing? Why are people rejecting it so soundly? Well, I think that it's been made to be a political issue by people in power. And that's been a very, you know, it might have been an indecisive thing, but it's proven to be something that's stuck. And I do think that it's become tied. You know, I teach media law at UT. And one of the things that I know is that as Americans, we care a lot about free speech. I care a lot about free speech. We care about a lot about our civil rights and care a lot about, you know, appropriately for this show, right? We care a lot about that stuff. But at the same time, there are things that we have to do to protect the rest of society. In some ways, I think this individualist stream in American culture has kind of made us more reluctant to wear masks.
Jim, you've been in the civil rights business for umpteen years now. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Not as organized as it is now. I mean, we certainly would get calls, especially with regard to discrimination, you know, white people calling and articulating the same sort of stuff that you hear right now, you know, that minority folks are going to take over and immigrants are going to take over. Why they were calling us is beyond me. But I heard it a lot, but it was never organized and legitimized in the way that it is now, and that the way that this, that Trump and the administration have done it. And I find it to be quite alarming, actually. And I think you see the radical side of this, you know, the folks out on the streets with the guns. And I agree with what Sam's saying is, and we sort of have a really emphatic individualism going on right now, you know, and you don't hear the calls for patriotic approach to this like you would hear in Canada, you know, that we all wear masks. It's a patriotic thing to do to help each other and that kind of thing. It's just this is rugged individualism. And of course, it's having catastrophic. Look what it's doing in the rural areas. Look what it's doing in West Texas. You know, it's crazy.
And I think you're right. It's not unrelated to the domestic terrorism, you know, the militias. I remember several weeks ago when the attempt to kidnap the governor of Michigan finally came out, you know, and you and I were texting that night. And I just remember having a sense of foreboding about all this, you know.
Yeah, what's your take on that, Sam?
What you have here is you have a situation where disinformation is flowing from, and I use disinformation specifically, flowing from the highest levels of government. And you also have a person in power at the moment that leverages polarization and an us versus them mentality in his political style to the extent that there's this perception amongst his base that everything he says is true and anything that's against him is false. And that's why we kind of are in this situation that we're in many ways. There was always a problem, you know, right? I started studying disinformation and propaganda back when Obama was the president. And of course, politicians have lied for a really long time. And social media has been used for manipulation for a long time. But we've never seen it endorsed, disinformation and propaganda that is endorsed to such an extent and used to such an extent as a primary political strategy. For the longest time, this stuff has been in the shadows. It's and it remains in the shadows, and to the extent that, like, we a lot of the time we don't know who's doing what. But I can say that, you know, what we're seeing right now, for instance, surrounding the election, or what we saw during the situation in Michigan, these are attempts by Trump in the situation of Michigan to openly sort of stand against a governor who was potentially going to be the victim of a kidnapping. And in the situation of the election, openly spread false stories about the voting process in America, which is at the heart of our democracy. And that's incredibly concerning to me. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. You know, that's a real worry.
But, and you know, the thing, though, I mean, to go back to Michigan, is that even after this happened and he would be out with the crowds, I mean, he would get right to that brink almost of saying, go do it again. Of egging people on and legitimizing that activity so that people don't look at it in horror that here, I mean, what was going on? The governor of the state was going to be kidnapped and killed.
Yeah, exactly.
It's frightening and to some extent. I mean, so let me ask you about this. A lot of people make the comparison where we are now and Trump and the propaganda to the early days pre-Hitler, or at the time of Hitler days, what was going on in Germany. To what extent is there a comparison, do you think, if any?
Yeah, you know, I should begin by saying that I'm not a historian, so I don't know a ton about the Third Reich and the rise of Hitler. But what I do know is that dictators and people who desire complete power, you can call them authoritarians, oftentimes present similar types of desires for control, similar personality types. You know, we see like a lot of narcissism and sociopathy amongst these kinds of folks. And I think that there are parallels there. I think that the cultural contexts are very, very different from between today and then. But I do think that Donald Trump really truly dismisses what we think of as the truth, dismisses science, dismisses education, journalism. And that's particularly worrying for me as a scholar of media, as a scholar of political communication, because it really, what it does is it degrades things at the foundation of our democracy. It degrades our trust in institutions that are really, really important, you know, like education, like journalism, for checking and balancing the things that the government can or cannot do. And so it's sort of like this situation, and I think, Jim, you're alluding to this, wherein you have a leader who's kind of suggesting the opposite of what they're actually doing. They're saying, I'm attacking the press because the press is corrupt, when in fact the press is attempting to hold the leader accountable for being corrupt. It's like the funhouse mirror almost.
And now the lie count is over 25,000.
Yeah.
One of the things we pointed out 2 weeks ago was that it hit 20,000 this past July. And I noted that the rate of lying had actually accelerated. The first 10,000 took about 800 some days. The next 10,000 only took 400 some days, you know?
That's interesting to point out, Bob, because, you know, what that suggests is that Donald Trump got more comfortable in his position and felt more and more comfortable with lying. And I would argue that he was bolstered by the political infrastructure and by the sort of cronyism that we see happening right now, sort of spinning out. In the early days of the Trump administration, and especially during, you know, pre-Trump's inauguration, we saw people like Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, lots of people in the Republican Party at quite a high level speaking out against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of sort of turning over and just sort of going with the flow with this disinformation stuff. And the more people that sort of side with him within his own party and refuse to speak out against him, the more inclined he feels to speak falsehoods. And this is, I guess, like, you know, one thing that bears saying for me is that I grew up in a conservative town in rural Colorado on a farm and surrounded by a lot of great people who identified as Republicans and conservatives. This is like antithetical to what I was taught that those folks believed and what they told me they believed. And so it's just interesting to see how the Republican Party has changed and how Donald Trump has really morphed it into something that, you know, is unrecognizable.
Well, prior to the election, you know, we were subjected to a kind of a drumbeat to undermine confidence in the mail-in ballots, you know, and now I'm quite sure that that was all planned to actually try to save his campaign here in the post-election days, you know, because that's exactly what he's claiming, that all these mail-in ballots were fraudulent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Donald Trump, the writing was on the wall and Donald Trump was reading it, you know, like the polls looked a lot different than they did in 2016. Yes, the polls were still wrong to a degree, but Donald Trump and the Trump campaign were extremely worried. And so they set themselves up to be, they teed themselves up to be able to do exactly what we're seeing now. And so quite frankly, I'm not surprised at all that we're seeing what's happening happen. And not only because they teed themselves up to do it, because it's very, very much the sort of thing that Donald Trump has done throughout his presidency.
Well, near as I can tell, these lawsuits over fraudulent balloting and whatnot are just being tossed out left and right. Story in the New York Times this morning that they had called all 50 states, election officials in all 50 states. There was only one state that refused to speak with them, by the way, and that was Texas. And the other 49, they were quite assured that all of the ballot counting was on the up and up, and that the state officials, whether they were Democrat or Republican, had no evidence at all of any sort of fraud being foisted on the American people in a massive fashion.
Yeah, I've seen the same exact stories. You know, I saw stories from our neighbor to the north, Oklahoma, and from folks there basically saying like, nope, there's been no electoral manipulation here, no fraud, same for Kansas. I also saw a story of a judge in Pennsylvania asking one of Trump's attorneys, Goldstein, I think it was, whether or not they were alleging fraud in Pennsylvania. And the poor guy put on the spot said, no, not at this time. And so, I mean, it really gives you the sense that these lawsuits are pretty frivolous. I'm not the legal expert here.
So Sam, let me ask you this question, you know, about the misinformation or this information that's being drummed out. Is it your view that this is put out, that people who consume this really understand this as fact, or do they just latch onto it because it justifies where they are maintaining their position in society? Or is there like a combination of that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's probably a combination. What we know from the psychological research is that people have a real need to belong. I wrote this paper back in January of this year for the National Endowment for Democracy in DC. The paper was called, I think it was called something like The Demand for Deceit. And it was about all the reasons why people consume disinformation and propaganda. One of the things I learned while writing that is, you know, people's, say, for instance, confirmation bias, a desire to believe in what they already believe and to suss out and to seek out what they want to see in something is massive. And so we know that. We also know that there's something called the bandwagon effect. So if people around them are doing something, others are more likely to do it. And so with disinformation, that's certainly the case.
Our guest this evening is Sam Woolley, member of the faculty at the UT School of Journalism. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This program was homecrafted and recorded on November 11th. We're talking with Sam Woolley from the UT School of Journalism about misinformation and disinformation. Let's continue where we left off.
We were talking about whether the press was getting better. I mean, they've been complimenting themselves that they're getting better, you know, in handling Trump, but whether Sam's perception is that they are getting better at this, or have they just sort of identified the problem? Now, the danger of just repeating it, the disinformation gets it out there, even if it's not true, even if the press discredits it, but it gives it legitimacy, even raising it up and talking about it.
You know, there's this concept known as Whitney Phillips, who's a scholar on the East Coast, has this concept of the oxygen of amplification. And what she says is, you know, she's been saying this for years now, that the press has to think really carefully before they give oxygen or they amplify particular news stories like disinformation or like false claims by the president. And so I think what you're referring to there, Jim, is that the press is probably doing a bit of patting themselves on the back for actually not reporting on some of this content about electoral fraud because it's potentially just damaging to report it in and of itself. And so that might be sort of what's going on here. I, for one, am actually kind of glad when the press doesn't pick up on disinformation stories and re-report on them, because oftentimes what I've learned through my studies of propaganda has been that propagandists specifically want the press to take their disinformation and share it more publicly. That is their goal. People at the highest levels of government know that, but so do people in extreme politics, whether it's terrorists or far right white supremacists and others.
You know, in listening to the coverage of the ballot counting, what got a lot of attention was the fact that the Republican protesters were not being granted access to the ballot counting facility. And, you know, on a few occasions, I would hear the media just kind of repeating that story. And yet in my own head, knowing that inside of that facility, there are already Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so that's precisely Bob, the kind of problem that we're seeing. And so the media actually reporting upon that story is giving the idea that protesters should have been allowed entrance into the vote counting areas some legitimacy, when in fact, that's a totally preposterous idea. The idea that it would let political protesters into a vote counting area, I mean, when there's already people that are trained to do that from both the Democrat and the Republican parties, is just absolutely crazy to me.
Yep, I agree. Let's change the topic just a little bit here. There's been a lot of attention on social media, you know, and going back to 2016, I think we could see that a lot of social media was really naive at best and were being played in many ways. Did that improve at all in 2020? And if so, what do you attribute that to?
Sure. So social media companies, primarily the large platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, have made some serious strides in combating disinformation and political propaganda. We've seen things like Twitter put a ban on political advertisements and Facebook follow suit, at least for the time being, they say for the next month or so. We've also seen Twitter labeling a lot of disinformative tweets, even ones that are coming from Donald Trump and other quarters. We've also seen attempts of these companies to work across the aisle, I guess you might say, with academics and public interest technologists and scholars. There's still a lot of work to do. You know, like there's still the fact here that these companies are concerned most with the bottom line. They are oriented towards making money. And anyone that saw the new Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, will understand that there's this kind of concept that's very much the case in which these companies are oriented towards trying to get people to spend as much time as possible on the platforms. They're not trying to get you to leave the platform. They want you to spend time there and they want you to see advertising content because these companies make their money through ads. And so, you know, in some ways, what we've asked of the companies is a little bit much. We've asked these companies that are invested in getting us to see ads to be really careful in self-regulating that those exact advertisements. The fact is, like, sure, the companies can regulate the advertisements as we know them, the normal ads, but most of the content we're talking about, the disinformation and the propaganda, appears natively. In other words, it appears in your Twitter feed. It appears in Facebook groups. It appears in the WhatsApp groups. It appears in Instagram comments. Oftentimes now what we're seeing even is influencers, these folks on social media who have large followings, being paid by political organizations to spread particular political content and not sharing the fact that they're spreading political content. And so, you know, social media companies have made a lot of progress, I think, and they deserve credit for making that progress. They still have a ton of work to do, and there's new problems that are going to continue to arise, like the rise of the paid political influencer. Simultaneous to all of this, we still need regulation at a federal level of this space. And the United States government has held all these congressional hearings with Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey and others. But to me, it feels like a lot of pomp and circumstance and more of like a marketing technique than it does seem geared towards generation of actual policy. And so my hope is that with a Biden presidency and with some bipartisan collaboration, including like potentially between Congressman Hawley and Mark Warner and others who have created legislation together about this kind of stuff, we'll begin to see more policy action in the space that's actually really sensible and informed by people who really understand the technology.
Is that what it's going to take? Is regulation from on high, or is there any hope that these platforms will self-regulate?
Yeah, you know, I think that the platforms have basically drugged their feet from day one on the self-regulation bit. Like, we've been sharing this research with them since 2013. Other researchers have been doing this stuff since 2010 in computer science and sharing this content. they've known that disinformation and political propaganda exists on social media, and they've drugged their feet on it. It wasn't until the 2016 election and everything that sort of came to a head there that they began doing a bit more, but it's still been too slow and it's still been too little too late, you know, and we're asking too much. I mean, listen, like TV is regulated, radio is regulated. All of the kinds of media that we consume are regulated in some way, shape, or form. It's just the United States government made decisions early on, particularly the Federal Elections Commission in the early 2000s, to not regulate political speech and paid political propaganda in the early 2000s. And now the problem has grown outside of the capacity of most people to conceptualize. You know, we're talking about Facebook, a platform that has over 2 billion with a B users. And so I think the government's scared. I think they don't quite know how to deal with the problem. But suffice to say, these platforms are media. They are media platforms. They do curate information. They tell us which trends to look at, what news to read, all of those kinds of things. And so they do need to be regulated by the government in the same way that other media have been regulated for a long time. Because, and this is the bottom line, the idea that the marketplace of ideas, the open marketplace of ideas prevails, you know, this marketplace of ideas in which the best ideas always rise to the surface, that's just flat out not true online. Online, oftentimes the things that spread the most, and this is according to empirical research, are conspiracy theories and bad news.
Hey, Sam, I was going to ask you kind of what the research and the studies are being done these days about how to combat misinformation on social media, especially given that that's really the young generation's basic platform for getting their news on. So we talked about critical thinking needs to be taught better in education. But, you know, those of us that didn't grow up on social media, like Bob and me and Jim and everybody, we learned how to disseminate what the news around us, what was real versus disinformation, I think a lot differently than the generation does today. So how do you, you know, see that being combated for generations to come, given that the social media platforms are only going to grow and morph into different things? It's just like, how do you combat that? I mean, regulation obviously is part of it.
Excellent question. Yeah, Michelle, thanks so much. I think like this is the crux of the issue here. How are we going to deal with this problem as it exists on social media? I think we've got to cop to the fact that disinformation and propaganda looks a heck of a lot different on social media than it ever looked on TV or radio. You know, TV and radio are broadcast mediums where it's sort of a one-to-many system, if you like. Social media is a many-to-many system where almost anyone can create propaganda and disinformation. And, you know, in theory, almost anyone can go viral. And we also know from the research that social media platforms can be manipulated to make propaganda and disinformation go viral. And so what do we do here? Well, there's kind of a revolution occurring right now in fact-checking. And for a long time, you know, what we thought of as fact-checking was newspapers fact-checking themselves. So if they messed up on an article, they would issue a correction on that article. Now what we're seeing is news organizations fact-checking individuals or social media companies fact-checking individuals or fact-checking groups. And it's almost as if they're like testing everything out and see what, in an attempt to see what works, because we know that the system of fact checking, you know, just going to someone and saying, hey, you're wrong, doesn't work. The research shows us that if you just go to someone and say, hey, what you shared is false, they're actually almost more likely to double down and believe in that content than they are to throw it out or be embarrassed or you know, have a mea culpa. And so we have to create new methods of fact checking. And I think that those methods of fact checking need to make use of things like crowdsourcing. They need to make use of collaboration, the kind of collaboration we see on platforms like Wikipedia. And as I said, you know, with my new book, The Reality Game, we've got to re-envision what our platforms look like in order to really understand how fact checking can evolve. At present, you know, we see Facebook and these platforms partnering up with folks like Snopes or the Associated Press in attempts to fact check particular news streams of articles. We see them attempting to like do innovation with AI, but in a lot of ways, like we're not seeing that much that's new. And, you know, I'm hoping that we'll continue to see more and more innovation in this space. I do think that organizations like Nieman Labs, which is a journalism institute at Harvard, the Poynter Institute out in Florida, these kinds of organizations are doing a lot of creative work. Also First Draft, which is this fantastic organization that does a lot of research on disinformation around news media. they're actually creating new and innovative ways to combat this stuff. And I'm actually really confident that in the next couple of years that we're going to see a whole lot of new methods for countering disinformation and propaganda arise in the digital sphere.
Yeah, I was reading another article in the New York Times today about the new social media apps that are popping up and becoming more popular now because, you know, what we call now mainstream social media sites like Twitter and Facebook and everything are starting to double down on monitoring disinformation. And so all these conservatives are now, I've heard, just was reading, are now like turning to new apps like Parler, I guess is one of them, and mm-hmm. Newsmax. And mm-hmm. so all these in social media spheres, we can just create our own reality, so to speak.
Right. And there's been concerns about the issue of echo chambers, even on these mainstream platforms where people tend to follow like more diverse groups. But, you know, on platforms like Parler or Gab or Discord, you know, they're even more sort of segregated from reality. We're seeing kind of like a balkanization of the social media platforms in which, you know, you have a few that are really powerful and then you have a couple that are set aside and separate. And many of these ones that are set aside and separate are end-to-end encrypted. So researchers like me have pretty much no way of studying them other than to speak to propagandists. And so I've made it my sort of next research project, actually my ongoing research project for the last year at UT, to study encrypted messaging apps and try to understand how this disinformation and propaganda is flowing on those apps and what the sort of effects are. And, you know, the jury's out. We know that disinformation propaganda flows in on platforms like WhatsApp and on Telegram and things like that. Parler and Gab and these kind of more political, and I say this kind of with air quotes, free speech oriented apps are much less studied and much less open to being studied.
What else is going on in your sphere, Sam?
Yeah, so I have a couple different research projects. I mentioned the encrypted messaging apps project. I'm also doing a project right now on what I'm calling geopropaganda, which is this kind of new thing in which groups are attempting to reverse engineer what was known back in 2015 as the Facebook Graph API. Basically, Facebook offered this system where political organizations and other entities could really target people on quite a very granular level, like in small groups or even to some extent on an individual basis. And so people are using geographic data, so from people's cell phones, people's unique cell phone ID numbers. They're drawing these things called geofences in attempts to gather information on where people are spending their time. So are they going to the shooting range? Are they going to church? Are they going to the abortion clinic? And then using that information to combined with information, say, from credit reporting agencies, the information that's purchased from a variety of different third-party applications that people have on their phones, and then trying to recreate this Facebook Graph API using the geographic data and other data in order to try to recreate the kind of individualized advertising that we saw promised by groups like Cambridge Analytica, with whom many of the listeners will probably be familiar. And so this geopropaganda phenomenon is pretty concerning because it kind of brings together the issue of data and data ownership and data privacy, those issues, together with this issue of propaganda and computational propaganda. So that's one thing I'm focusing on and attempting to get the word out on. I'm also kind of working on a new book. Well, not kind of. I just finished a draft. It's called Manufacturing Consensus. It's a riff on Herman and Chomsky's sort of classic work on propaganda, manufacturing consent. And so in Manufacturing Consensus, you know, a lot of what I've talked about today is drawn from that book. I kind of talk about the ways in which propaganda has substantively changed since the 80s when Chomsky and Herman wrote that book, and make this argument that we've got to rethink how we understand propaganda in order to effectively combat it. And we can't keep applying Cold War-oriented strategies for fighting propaganda to today because the media system looks absolutely completely different. And so what I endeavor to do in that book is, you know, retrofit the work of Herman and Chomsky onto, you know, a new kind of framework for helping scholars, policymakers, activists, journalists, and regular people, helping them to understand disinformation and propaganda in a new and unique way.
Sounds like material for yet another show here, huh?
Yeah, and I think that should be out sometime in 2021. We'll see. It's a more academic book. It's with Yale University Press this time, and hopefully they'll get it published sooner rather than later, but I have to go through peer review on that guy.
Okay. Jim, any final remark?
No, this has been enlightening, if not depressing. Keep up the good work, Sam. Keep it up. We depend on you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'll keep fighting the good fight. And there's lots more people jumping on the bandwagon, of which I'm really happy about, of fighting this fight. So
Right.
Great.
And Michelle, anything else? Or?
No, it's been interesting. I'm always, you know, this stuff is fascinating to me, and I only feel like I understand a fraction of it, you know.
Join the club.
Yeah. Well, I really want to thank you, Sam. It's been a pleasure again.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you all very much. If you want me to come on again, I love this show.
Take care.
Well, it's now Friday the 13th, and we're checking in with our friend Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Austin?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, thanks for joining us here on this crazy and busy morning for both of us. What's happening at City Hall these days?
Business has been kind of slow, regular business. Three council members were campaigning and up for re-election, so things had kind of slowed down a little bit. Council did meet Thursday, November 12th, pretty brief meeting. They didn't pass anything of super consequence. They're starting on this program, which will help the city pay for roadway infrastructure from developments. That's been kind of in the works for several years, but that only passed on first reading. It's got to get voted on another time. Things have been pretty quiet because of the elections and all the campaigning.
We know that the presidential election is dragging on, but for two of our city council people, their own elections are kind of dragging out too.
Thankfully, our elections are dragging out under the normal electoral process, not some kind of scheme alleging fraud without any evidence like the president is doing. But yeah, locally, we've got runoff elections, which are pretty typical in local elections with races that have, you know, more than two or three candidates. The further down ballot you get, most voters, they're just, you know, less familiar with the candidates. And so there tends to be more runoffs in the further down ballot in local races. So at city council, two races went to runoff, District 6 and District 10. Both are West Austin districts. District 6 is Northwest Austin, and actually part of it is in Williamson County. Some of the precincts and some of the residents live in the Austin portion of Williamson County. And then District 10 is more central Austin and then out to the west and the hills. So Jimmy Flanagan in District 6 and Allison Alter in District 10 are once again in runoffs this cycle.
Well, it's interesting, first of all, that I suspect that both of them are being challenged on some of the more controversial issues that we've seen out of council, specifically reallocation of funds for APD and the homeless actions that they've taken in the last couple of years. Let's start with Jimmy Flanagan. He's actually chair of the council's public safety committee, and he's probably right in the crosshairs on this APD issue, I imagine.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. In both races, the two issues you named, police funding and the decriminalization of homelessness, have been front and center, you know, in a way, kind of the only issues. District 10 is a little different, but especially District 6, those have really been the only issues that the opponents of the incumbent in District 6, it's Mackenzie Kelly, who is facing off against Jimmy Flanagan in the runoff. It's basically the only issue she's talking about. And Mackenzie, she ran for city council in 2014 when it was kind of a circus elections. That was the first cycle after the 10-1 council was established. So there was just a lot of candidates in basically every race. She didn't do well. She finished, you know, in the bottom of the pack. She's back again. And she has really been a critic of the city council's votes to, you know, loosen restrictions on public camping and panhandling and sitting in line as they did in June of 2019. And she had been really a critic of those moves and had been in the Republican conservative space of groups that have been opposing the council and the mayor on those decisions going back to 2019. So she was always eyeing a run, and that was her issue. And then really the police funding just kind of like fell into her lap. It's an issue that's primed for, you know, mischaracterization and, you know, frankly, outright lies from the right wing in characterizing what the council has done or what they intend to do. And so that, you know, really became an issue of prominence for her. She has a lot of support from law enforcement, obviously. And so she's really been campaigning hard against Jimmy's, not just votes for those issues. Jimmy is chair of the public safety committee. And in that role, He's really been a champion of council's process for what they're calling reimagining public safety, which began by first cutting $21 million from the police budget by mostly by canceling these cadet classes, and then, you know, laying out a plan for cutting up to $150 million from the budget. And so, yeah, it's not just that he has voted and supported this initiative. He's really been a driving force. And especially at the Public Safety Committee, that is where this council committee talks to staff, city staff, and police officers and community advocates about how to actually do these changes. You know, it's one thing to say we're going to cut millions of dollars from the police budget and reallocate it into other services. Actually implementing and carrying out that work is quite difficult. And, you know, Jimmy has been sort of the face of that, him and, you know, Greg Kassar, obviously. It certainly has drawn him ire. And I think that's sort of reflected in the vote totals. I don't have the exact percentages in front of me, but I think he finished in first among the four candidates with something like 38% of the vote. But every other candidate in the race ran to his right, specifically against the police funding and the homelessness issues. So those candidates got more votes than Jimmy did in total, which is, I think, a little troubling for progressives in the city who really see this race, maybe not as much in District 10, but District 10 or District 6 for sure, kind of a symbolic push against the progressive policies this council has pushed.
Sure. And the history of that district is interesting too. I mean, talk about wild swings. You know, Jimmy replaced Don Zimmerman. You couldn't find anybody more right-wing than that, in my mind, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And Mackenzie Kelly is not far off. She bristles against the comparison to Don Zimmerman, but, you know, ideologically, she's aligned. And I would say in experience, you know, she is similar to Don Zimmerman in that she doesn't have a lot of experience in public policy. And I think you could say the same for Allison Alter's opponent, Jennifer Burden. These are people who have never held elected office, which, you know, in itself is not a bad thing. But they also just don't have the kind of experience and advocacy, community organizing that Jimmy or Allison do. And I think it's reasonable to disagree with the votes that either Jimmy or Allison have taken. I certainly do. But you can't knock the work that they put into the job. You know, they're dedicated, committed. They know the policy areas in and out. And in my conversations with both Jennifer and Mackenzie, that depth of knowledge just doesn't come through either of them. It's a stark difference.
Interesting. I actually live in 10. You know, my assessment of this district is that it would be a tough one for anybody to be, you know, running for city council here, because I think you have to walk a real tightrope here. And I suspect the same is true for 6 as well.
What I didn't say but should have is that District 6 and 10 have the highest number of Republican conservative voters in Austin. It's still a minority. It's about, you know, what you see in the county as a whole, about 30%, 25-30% of the electorate in these districts is Republican or votes in Republican primaries. So you're absolutely right. The representatives kind of have to walk a fine line, which Allison Alter has been much more in the political center than Jimmy Flanagan, especially on the land development code, which is, you know, an especially important issue in District 10. That's a really engaged electorate on that issue specifically. They do a lot of advocacy at City Hall. Not as much of an issue in Jimmy's district for those voters, but they're certainly engaged as well, and especially on the police funding and the decriminalization of homelessness. Yeah, he has not, you know, I think this is to his credit, someone who says he's a progressive, and not just in words, but, you know, in the votes he's taken and the risks he's taken electorally. You know, he knew full well when he voted to decriminalize homelessness and when he voted to reduce the police budget, those votes would be used against him, likely by a conservative, well-funded opponent. And that's exactly the position he's found himself in.
Going to be interesting. That's December 15th. Is that right?
Yeah. Early voting will start, I want to say December 3rd. I may be wrong about that, but I know it's early December. And then Election Day is December 15th. That's right.
I imagine it's going to be really important to get the vote out. But, you know, the problem is in these runoffs, the turnout is, you know, pretty slim.
Yeah. They local elections have lower turnout already. And then when they go to runoff, they have even lower turnout. And so, yeah, that's really the big effort for these campaigns is just motivating voters to go out to the polls once again.
Well, we'll be watching that for sure. I know all my neighbors are up here in the northwest corner of town.
Right.
Well, I really appreciate your working us in here, Austin. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good talking with you again. Thanks, Bob.
Well, that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone.